This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here today with Joe Bagley from VMware.
My name's Joe Bagley. I'm the CTO and Vice President for Europe, Middle East and Africa for VMware. I work as part of the Office of the CTO globally. My job is sort of 50-50 inbound, outbound. Half my time spent working on what we're doing next, and the other half is spent talking to people about what we're doing next. So people say it's actually 50-50 Chief Technology Officer and Chief Talking Officer is probably the best way to look at it. And VMware, we're famous for essentially inventing virtualization on x86, I suppose, if you want to call it that. But we were the people that first to market, and for over 15 years now, we've become the de facto standard for running servers in data centers is to virtualize them on VMware. We've spanned out a lot, obviously, and changed a lot in 15 years, and now it's not necessarily just about virtualization. It's about what we call the software-defined data center, which includes virtualizing both network and storage as well as compute and all the bits that go with that. But realistically, we're the providers of operating systems for data centers globally.
Virtualization, containers, virtual machines, they're words that have been around for a very long time in this industry, but they're also words that create massive amounts of confusion. How do you explain to people where they all overlap, where they sit together, and where they differ?
There's different types of virtualization. The classic virtualization that VMware deals with is bare metal virtualization. So we're taking a server, we put our software on that server, and then we make that server look like multiple more bare metal servers. And you can then turn up and install anything you like, Windows, Linux, whatever you want on top of that. So that's the classic VMware vSphere hypervisor. And that's how people have done it for years and years and years. And then along comes what is supposedly new in containers, which isn't new at all, as you alluded to, which is instead of actually having hyper virtualization at the bare metal, we're now going to have virtualization at the operating system level. So I'm going to install a copy of Windows, for example, and then I'm going to make that Windows pretend it's 10 copies of Windows to 10 different applications. So each application thinks it's getting its own box. And that's essentially how containers works. It's nothing new than Terminal Server did on Windows many years ago, or let's go back to WPARS and we'll go back to mainframes. And I had a conversation with my father about that. There's nothing new in that concept. The challenge was that when you're moving to the world that we're now moving over, microservices, which is where people want to be spinning up and down thousands of much smaller entities for their application and spinning them down again and killing them and cloning them, it was much easier and faster when they started doing that 3 or 4 years ago to do it in containers within an operating system than it was to spin up and down VMs. We now have this world where we've got the next extreme past, which is platform as a service, and even beyond that, which is serverless. And so now you're looking at a blended mix. And the challenge now when I talk to architects and application developers is deciding what's the best architecture to use. And in fact, what you'll find as you go through time is people use different architectures for different parts of different applications. You're not going to suddenly get everything that runs in a VM and put it in a container. In fact, some of the worst container implementations are what we call V2C, which is someone's just taken something that was in a VM and dragged and dropped in a container, which is awful. Likewise, you're not going to take everything in a container and go and do it on PaaS. What you're going to do is you're going to say, I need to develop an application, and different bits are going to sit in different places.
Part of the confusion isn't helped when people talk about the number of objects they can deploy. Earlier this year, we saw IBM talk about going from 8,000 VMs on a mainframe to as much as 2 million containers. But this isn't apples to apples. At one point, you're talking about an object that might contain an operating system plus an application. At the other end of the cycle, it's a microservice, which might just be 20 lines of code. How do people begin to even put together their idea of an architecture to support this?
You're a very good point. Some of the largest VMs we run have terabytes of RAM for supporting things like SAP HANA. So they're huge, right down to tiny, tiny containers. The challenge that people are going to have in their mind, as I said, is that one about architecture as they start to move things further up the stack. It actually comes down to speed of response, but also there's trade-offs at each level. A really good example is a website. Amazon would be a good one, for example. I'm not saying this is how they do it, but if you think about how you go through that website, when you first browse the website, you're finding that what you're searching for is coming up really quickly, and you're able to put things in the basket really quickly, and the comparison, it's all fast, 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 bang, bang, bang. That's fine, because you could be maybe doing that in a microservices architecture where if I can spin things up and down really fast, I'm spinning up little things just to do searches for you and killing them again, and it's not a problem. The minute I start to click checkout, you'll find things start to slow down, and that's because I'm moving from a sort of ephemeral environment of microservices down to a much more systems of record transactional system as I go through. And if I'm dealing with financial transactions, I can't have an ephemeral architecture where I've got things popping up and disappearing. I've got to start managing state somewhere. So that's a really good example of where you might then be transitioning to a traditional database system running a transaction system on VMware virtual machines. The front end might be running on microservices, which might equally be running on VMware virtual machines, or could actually be running in Amazon, for example, and handing off between. It's not a case of, I've got to do X, I've got a choice of doing it in all three, or whatever. One of them is going to be the best way to do this, and there's architectural choices to be made. Now, as people are moving forward in architecture, people are starting to adopt more of the microservices approaches and 12-factor, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's going to drive a greater adoption of that. But as far as we're concerned, it's just another workload that sits on top of it, because pretty much every container I've ever seen runs in a VM anyway. So you're all going to be running VMs.
Delivering those workloads, again, at speed and at scale becomes a challenge. We've had scheduling orchestration systems for 15, 20, 30, 40 years if we start to talk mainframe. And the big discussion in containers is all about how do we orchestrate better. What makes the difference between how we've always done orchestration to a new world? Is it simply at scale?
In essence, it's a scale thing. Most of the orchestrators and schedulers that we've got today are not designed for scheduling millions of things. They're designed for scheduling hundreds of things or thousands of things. And so actually, we're seeing scale limitations in even the architecture of the schedulers themselves. You've got people have amazing schedulers that aren't even multi-master in their own architecture. You're going to have a limitation there. So we're starting to see the emergence of new types of schedulers, such as Kubernetes, which is coming out of Google. And Google have been running their infrastructure on containers for 15 years plus, so they know what to do with containers. That's now coming into the real world as people start to say, okay, I need a scalable engine, because what you're looking at here is actually the fundamental change is reliability is moving from hardware to software. If you look at the way this evolved, originally we did reliability in hardware. We had redundant power supplies, we had RAID arrays, we had all these wonderful things. And then over time, all that redundancy is now being done in software. Originally, it was done in software by people like VMware. We were putting layers in software in there that made it feel like the hardware was doing the resilience, but in fact, we're doing it in software with things like SRM and DRS and other technologies. Now, with microservices and containers, which has come out of the world of using large-scale public clouds, where bits of it can just disappear randomly because of the SLAs and the price point you're getting stuff at, developers are having to think about availability in their architecture. And I suppose I think that's really the biggest difference, is whereas you've got a tipping point from where before a developer could rightly assume that the processor and the storage and the network were always going to be there, and that was somebody else's problem in operations. The rub you've now got is that the developers are now having to see, oh, I've got to worry about designing for failure. I've got to think in my architecture, what happens if half my containers disappear?
But is this not a backward step? We've spent 20, 30 years, from where I've observed the industry and written about it, continually telling people, assume this exists.
Yeah.
We no longer write a network driver. We no longer write a storage driver. We no longer write video drivers. We just assume it's there. But here we are, taking that step back and actually saying to developers, assume it might not be there. How do we change that mindset without repeating some of the silliness we did in the past?
That's exactly what you're seeing going in the market right now. I don't think there's an answer for that, and I think that's the challenge. I think you're seeing some of the older people in the industry saying, we did this all before, and some of the younger people going, no, we know what we're doing. And then my favourite one was saying, oh, we're doing this thing called design for failure. Have you heard of it? And I went, yeah, I designed RAID arrays. That's what design for failure. We expected disks to fail. I know what that is. I think you're right. It's having people to the stuff they expected to exist before, they've now got to worry about themselves as they go further up the stack. And so that's the rub, and that's why you're now seeing people like ourselves and others coming out with production supportable stacks for such activities. So our recent announcement, PKS, which is the VMware Pivotal Kubernetes Service, which is for containers, is a production supported version of Kubernetes. So a developer can turn up and run containers and play with containers in a Kubernetes environment. But we on the back end are providing the operations team with all the necessary tools to sit there and make sure that this thing is available and has the right storage available and security, etc. Because again, the developers are now having to worry about things beyond reliability. They have to worry about security. They have to worry about identity management. They have to worry about all these things that previously I just used that service to do that, and now it's something I've got to think about. So it's an interesting world we developed down this road.
All of this at the end of the day is inexorably tied with cloud, not just public cloud or private cloud or hybrid cloud, but a whole mix of these installs. How does VMware sit into that? Because you've been around a long time. To many people, you've owned virtualization for the best part of 20 years. As you say, you created the x86 game here. You bought up all your competitors. Those you couldn't buy, you basically crushed as a company.
That's a bit harsh, Ian, but yeah.
How do you now move into the cloud in such a way as to become a new cloud platform?
Yeah.
Rather than just repeating, I suppose what I'm saying is, are you reinventing yourself as a born on the cloud company, or are you taking what you've got to the cloud?
I think the latter to an extent. In fact, we're helping our customers take what they've got to the cloud. I think that's the best way to put it. We've always talked since the start in this Octo, as we call it, Office of the CTO, about this operating system for clouds and this vision we've had around building a platform that includes compute, network and storage that initially spreads across multiple physical things in one data center, then multiple data centers, and then ultimately multiple clouds. The challenge is getting multiple clouds to run your operating system for it to work that way. And now with, I think, over 4,500 what we call VMware cloud provider partners, which includes people like Atos and OVH and Vodafone, etc., and then people like IBM and now ourselves running at VMware Cloud on Amazon, there's a whole wealth of destinations people can choose from. I had a conversation with someone recently where they said, oh, VMware, I don't want to put more money in VMware, I'm investing in the past. And I'm going, well, actually, what you're doing is you're missing out there, because by investing in what we're doing, you're investing in a transformative technology. Because what you don't realize, Mr. Customer, is for the last 15 years, we've been helping you box up all your applications and make them really portable, because they're now in these things called VMs. You can actually now move that VM while it's running live to Amazon. Would you like that? And they go, yeah, that's great. Now, the interesting thing is there's a risk of taking your really bad architecture and running your really bad architecture in the cloud. So I think, yes, we enable that. So, Mr. Customer, if you want to take the rubbish you've got and just run rubbish somewhere else on a different cost model, you're fine to. But actually what we're doing is just opening up choice. We've always been about giving people more choice, because people go, yeah, but you're locking them into VMware's platform or our operating system. Of course, I'm not going to say it's lock-in, but I'd like to say someone's investing in that because they see value in it because of the choice that it brings them, if that makes sense.
There is a lot to be said about stability, though, isn't there? Because if we look at many of the cloud platforms that we've got out there, they're all relatively new. They're all competing with each other and trying to find an edge as to why they're different. Whereas you're saying to companies, we can compete with them and we can be stable. For example, you focus very much now on vSphere as the underlying engine for your new cloud platform, and things like vCloud Air, you've done the deal with OVH where that's gone elsewhere, so you're laser focusing to some degree exactly where you want to be. Are people understanding the message, or are they, as you said earlier, still saying, but this is old technology?
I think we're providers of cloud operating technology, if that makes sense. We're not cloud operators. Yes, you touched on there, we sold vCloud Air off to OVH. Actually, the operation of vCloud Air is what we sold to OVH. The technology that we're using to operate it is still ours. And in fact, that's the arrangement we have with all our other partners. Being that provider of that technology that enables people to freely move between is, I think, very, very key. If you look historically at what VMware did, was we broke down silos in data centers. If you look at a data center of 20 plus years ago, it was very siloed in terms of different operating systems, different hardware vendors, very tightly integrated stacks, compared to the data centers of today, which is generally a bunch of who cares what x86 and some storage and some network, which is increasingly just some switches because we're now doing all the layer 3 to 7 stuff in software. You now say, okay, well, we're now doing that for the clouds, because people look at the clouds as being silos, because there's certain things you do when you go to a cloud that maybe tie you in architecturally, tie you in the way that you've built your scripts, tie you in various different ways. We're saying, actually, no, we're going to allow you to get the cost advantage and maybe access some of the cool services that cloud provider provides, but without you having to feel like you're tied into them in some way. And I think that's really important to stress, that we allow people to move around. So it's breaking those silos down between clouds as well. Longer term, yes, I'd like it to be that everyone looks at VMware as the technology that allows you to use multiple clouds.
If we look at the split between Tier 1 cloud and Tier 2 cloud, Tier 1 cloud, arguably Microsoft, Google, Amazon. They've hyper-built their own hardware now. Amazon's definitely been at it. Google's been at it. While Microsoft's moving down that line, they're taking a lot of hardware from other people, but actually what they do when they get it in is almost to reinvent BIOS and things like this to get the hyperscale they need. They've all built the software components to sit on top. When we look at Tier 2, they're generally buying commodity hardware. One or two, OVH, Rackspace, are doing some hardware development. But then they're buying a whole bunch of different operating systems to try and work out what takes them up into the Tier 1 space. You're becoming quite dominant in that space. It's between really you and OpenStack.
Yeah.
How do they start to scale the two between each other? Because many of these companies are running both at the moment.
You have to look at what people want and what people actually are providing. So people want an API to use a public cloud. They want to turn up and say, okay, I'm going to build an orchestration set of scripts using whatever to talk to an API. And that API is going to spin up my VMs, monitor my VMs, do all the things I want to do. We have the same opinion that the API is probably the most important thing. And in fact, I think as we go forward in the world, APIs are becoming the dominant thing to be worried about. What we're saying is, okay, if you're a cloud provider, what is it you actually do and where do you make your money and your margin? And the way you differentiate yourself as a cloud provider actually is on service. It's being able to be physically in a location that large cloud providers aren't. And then there's other ways you differentiate yourself from the tier one. Maybe you're a French company with French employees and the French law that can deal with the French government in a way that no one else ever could. Or maybe you've got specific network connections that no one else could. Or maybe you're giving an SLA that tier ones are never even going to go to that level of SLA because it's not where they live. That's where we're seeing differentiation. What you don't differentiate in is the cloud platform you run, because actually that's not where you should be spending your time and money. So if you can get an off-the-shelf cloud to take, run, and start providing services and then differentiate and do things on top of that. That's what we're seeing our providers do. Now, with OpenStack, one of the cool things is the OpenStack API. We provide the OpenStack API on top of our stack as well. So we'll provide you with an OpenStack API so you can come and talk OpenStack to that cloud too. And in fact, for NFV, we provide an OpenStack stack fully for the telco providers as well. So, and Vodafone have just selected us globally to run there. There's a lot to be said around OpenStack versus VMware, et cetera, et cetera. We're not seeing that in the field. I'm certainly not seeing a lot of OpenStack in private cloud. And in public cloud, I'm seeing people are realizing where they should be spending their time and money in building a cloud provider. Maybe it's not in building our own cloud. Because if you start doing that, you're competing with tier ones with a resource level you're never going to have. So it's almost, is that a done deal already? The tier ones is a fun base. And obviously, we're doing stuff with Amazon there as well. And we've got various deals with Azure as well, especially around our desktop stuff and other things. And we reach out to those. And obviously, Kubernetes with Google. So we're talking to them too.
Thank you very much for your time, Joe.
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Good to chat.